Hi, I'm Yusin.
And I'm Clarice.
We are the producers behind Separation Declassified, a recently released CNA documentary about Singapore's separation from Malaysia on 9th of August 1965.
Our documentary relied mostly on declassified British correspondences to piece together lesser-known facts about this momentous event. But now a new perspective has been opened to the public with the declassification and release of a one secret file codenamed the Albatross File. It was kept by Dr. Goh Keng Swee, the minister who negotiated the separation, in the months leading up to the 9th of August.
Yeah, so these files provide a first-hand perspective of what happened in the tense months leading up to the separation. And helping us unpack it all today is Mr. Janadas Devan, who is the senior advisor at MDDI and also the government's coordinator for this special project. So thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Okay, so I'm going straight into my first question. So this secret file that then Finance Minister Dr. Goh put together in the lead up to the separation was codenamed the Albatross.
Dr. Goh was very fond of codenames, and he codenamed this Albatross because the figure Albatross comes from this poem by Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, because there was a sailor in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner who killed an albatross, which was supposed to be a symbol of good luck. And the other sailors, as a curse, made him wear the albatross around his neck. So since that poem, the albatross became a figure of a tremendous burden around your neck. So that is why he used the figure albatross.
I mean, that's pretty dramatic.
Very poetic.
Yes. What does it tell us about why he started this file?
Well, we don't know precisely when he started the file, but the earliest document in the file was from July 1964. So he must have started the file sometime before or after the race riots in 1964, or he may have put those early documents later. None of the documents in the file were in the registry, and he obviously kept it himself because it was a mixed bag of all sorts of documents. There were cabinet papers in there, cabinet memos, his handwritten notes of his conversations later with Tun Razak, and also newspaper clippings, transcripts of Mr. Lee's speeches, the Malaysian Solidarity Convention in 65, or his famous speech in Parliament, in the Malaysian Parliament in May 27. Everything was in that file. So it was not a file that was properly filed.
And the public was first clued in on the existence of this file, you know, kind of in about 1996, was
96,
it?
96, the book appeared. This was Melanie Chu's Leaders for Singapore. And he was interviewed by Melanie Chu. And the interview was sometime in late 95, when in the course of the interview, he revealed the existence of this file. And he sort of referred to it. And that's when he first revealed that he had negotiated separation. And then later, 1998, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew wrote the first volume of his memoirs, The Singapore Story. He doesn't mention the Albatross file, but he makes reference to a number of the documents that were in the Albatross file, because by then he had himself seen the Albatross file.
But that was almost 30 years now, right? So why did we decide, you know, to kind of release this file to the public now?
Well, the contents of the Albatross file is just one part of this book. The other part of the book, actually the longer part, consists of excerpts from the oral histories of the key figures from that period, including Dr. Goh, as well as Mr. Lee Kuan Yew. And not all these oral histories were declassified till recently. Declassified meaning they were, by agreement with the people who gave these oral histories, they could only be released to the public 5 years or so after their death. So, you know, so we took time to go over these oral histories, and then we decided to put them all out to the public at one go, because the oral histories flesh out what are in the Albatross files. And it provides a much richer human context. And then when you go over the book, you realize that a lot of editing had to be done, because, you know, people misremember dates, misremember events, and you had to provide a context, an editorial apparatus, making references, including the British and Australian declassified documents. You know.
So all of this that you mentioned, the oral history, you know, the Albatross files, they are all published for the first time in a book titled The Albatross File Inside Separation.
That's right. I should say that this huge book I have here in typescript is about almost 500 pages. It is not a chronology. It is not a history. It is actually very highly processed raw material, right? Very interesting to read, very engrossing. There are no dramatic new revelations there. The basic story of how Singapore separated from Malaysia has been around for a long time. Mr. Lee told most of the story in his own memoirs. But what you have here is the rich human dimension, as provided for in the oral histories, their passion, their emotions, and their disagreements, and how we arrived at what was an unexpected outcome.
Well, I got to ask Mr. Chandadas, in this book, you know, from the Albatross Files, was anything left out?
Dr. Goh kept minutes of the meetings of the MSC, Malaysian Solidarity Convention. These were meetings that were held between Singapore's PAP leaders as well as other opposition parties in Malaysia. So we didn't include those because, first of all, Dr. Goh wasn't himself part of the Malaysian Solidarity Convention organizing committee, but he just kept these records in his thing. It is not immediately relevant to the events leading to separation. So those things we kept out. But nothing of substance was edited nor kept out of the Albatross file.
And so you were very involved in this project of sort of declassifying all of these and going through that massive file. You know, what was the thing that, I guess, surprised you the most when you were going through this?
Well, they are extraordinarily interesting to read because they give you a real-time look into how their thinking was developing as events were unfolding, right? So it is real-time, right? And a number of things surprised me. Number one, how intense was their thinking? The first document in the Albatross file proper was a huge, long memorandum that Mr. Lee Kuan Yew wrote before the race riots in 1964. And it was a long document of about 18, 20 pages. Very, very intense analysis of the lie of the political land. What if they did this? What if we did that? What are the options available? And so on. And it was very intense. And actually, many of the things he said there foresaw the events that were going to unfold, right? And I was very struck by, even at that point, before the race riots happened, he knew what was at stake. And he knew that if they were to concede what was the primary demand from the Malaysian leaders, especially the leaders of UMNO, the United Malay National Organization, that the Malay ground in Singapore and the rest of Malaysia should be left to UMNO and the PAP should not appeal to the Malay ground, even in Singapore. And they knew that if they considered that point, things would be easier for them. And they just refused. So there were certain principles they were just not ready to concede.
There is this one interesting quote in historian Professor Tan Tai Yong's introduction in the book, actually. He states that the Albatross file and the road to separation can only be understood in the context of the earlier journey towards merger. So, I mean, we all have to remember that the merger is the joining of Sabah, Sarawak, Singapore and Malaya to form the Federation of Malaysia in 1963. We know that we are separated by 1965, so that's barely 2 years after merger.
Less than two years.
And we know that the merger was something that the Singapore leaders fought so hard for.
Yeah.
So how did things fall apart so quickly?
Well, first of all, you have to understand why they got into Malaysia, because it was an article of faith. The first article in the PAP manifesto when it was formed in 1954, November, was merger with Malaya. And it was an article of faith. Everyone of that era, or most people of that era, accepted or felt that Singapore as an island city, let alone an island nation, cannot survive. You needed a hinterland. You needed a common market with Malaya. Now we think as though it was obvious from the very beginning that Singapore is a global city, where it wasn't obvious to them, right? Nobody thought of Singapore as a global city. And beyond that, they all felt Malayan. They thought of themselves as Malayan. Nobody referred to themselves as Singaporean, right? And so we got into Malaysia. And then why did it fail within 23 months? Well, there are a number of reasons, not all of which were obvious then, but number one, actually, the failure rests deep in our history. Singapore, for much of its colonial history, was part of the Straits Settlement. The Straits Settlement included Singapore, Malacca and Penang. It was governed by a governor, a British governor, who was stationed in Singapore. So we were more or less the chief city in the Straits Settlement, but we were part of the Straits Settlement. Following the Second World War, the British had a bright idea. They said, we'll put all of Malayan Peninsula together with Singapore in what they called a Malayan Union. Malayan Union failed to take off the ground. It was just failed. Why? Malaya by itself at that time, excluding Singapore, consisted of 1.9 million Chinese, 0.6 million or 600,000 Indians, and only 2.1 million Malays. Without Singapore, the Malays weren't a majority. They were a plurality, but they weren't a majority. And if you included Singapore, the Chinese would have overwhelmed the Malays. For that reason, the Malay elite established UMNO. UMNO was formed to oppose the Malayan Union. And Singapore was kept out of the Malayan Union. UMNO opposed the Malayan Union with or without Singapore because the Malayan Union proposal would have conferred citizenship on all 1.9 million Chinese. They didn't want that. So only a fraction of the Chinese in Malaya were given citizenship.
Why is that a problem, you know, at a point of time for...
Because they didn't want to be overwhelmed. They didn't want to be overwhelmed by the non-Malays. So they formed UMNO. And in effect, Singapore being kept out of the Malayan Union was the first separation. Right? We were no longer part of the Straits Settlement. You are a separate British colony. Mm-hmm. So after that, failure of Malayan Union, aborted, PAP was formed. And all the political parties in Singapore wanted merger, right? So actually, the merger in 1963 was re-merger. So if the first merger had to be aborted, why did anyone think that the second merger would work? Well, it wasn't obvious to them. Now, in retrospect, you can see how the fundamental contradictions that existed in 1945-46 were not resolved by 1963. They were still there. And then within 23 months, we learned they had not been resolved.
Yeah.
And so you got the second separation. Right? And this time you ended up not as a colony, a separate colony, but as a sovereign independent country.
Oh, before we fast forward to 1965.
That's the first reason.
Yeah, we got to go back to 63.
The second reason.
Yes.
Why it failed, I suppose, is the terms of merger, as we later discovered, were not right. Tunku Abdul Rahman's original idea for merger, bless his soul, was actually correct. He wanted Singapore to continue as it was between 1959 and 63 when we had self-government. You took care of your own affairs, right? But in place of the British, who took care of foreign affairs and defence, he wanted Kuala Lumpur to look after defence and foreign affairs. But in the course of negotiations, there was a man called Tan Siew Sin, who was their finance minister, who insisted on different arrangements. He wanted leverage over Singapore's finances. And as a result, we ended up with merger terms that gave Singapore autonomy in very limited areas, significant areas, but only in education and labour, right? Because they're not used to having trade unions there. We have trade unions here. Or, you know, rambunctious trade unions. So in those days, they were rambunctious. And some minor, some autonomy on health. And the Tunku actually later said, in print, that he was mistaken to have accepted Tan Siew Sin's insistence on those terms. If it had been different terms, well, we would have had less reason. Now, Singapore's leaders may have had less reason to interfere in their politics, right? Because They made policies on tax that affected us. They made policies on, you know, all sorts of things, approval for permits for industrialization and so on, that affected us, and therefore they had to respond. That's number two. Number three, well, go back to the fundamental contradictions. Their politics was based on race, ours wasn't. And it failed because they were not willing to accept that the Malays in Singapore could, in fact, support the PAP, a non-racial party. What happened was the first general election, second general election in our, since 1959, was held 5 days or so after we got into Malaysia. At that time, there were three Malay majority constituencies. And three, Geylang Serai, Kampung Kembangan, I think Southern Islands. They were, prior to 1963, represented by Singapore UMNO. 1963 elections, the Tunku came down, other UMNO leaders came down, alliance leaders came down to campaign against the PAP. And they lost. All three Malay constituencies were won by Malays from the PAP. And there was a huge reaction. The Tunku himself said the Malays in Singapore were traitors. He used the word traitors. And then within weeks of their defeat, they had organized demonstrations, agitated the Malay ground here. And within weeks, they were burning effigies of Lee Kuan Yew. And then the campaign began in earnest. For all these reasons, merger failed. There were interlinked reasons, but fundamentally, you had to go back to the fundamental contradictions that were historical, and they were not resolved, right? And by, as Dr. Goh, Mr. Lee, all say in their oral histories, once the race riots occurred in 1964, they knew that they had made a mistake, that what they had assumed was the guarantee of Singapore's success or safety was wrong.
The racial riots in 1964, July of 1964, is quite a significant event in our history. That happened barely a year after the merge.
10 months.
10 months. How important is this event?
It was cataclysmic. It shocked everybody. Dr. Goh recalls that Mr. Lee had a sense something was going to come. Something was about to happen. And then he didn't understand what Mr. Lee was talking about. And then the explosion occurred. That's all it took. You remember, 63, general elections, the PAP wins all three Malay majority constituencies against UMNO candidates. Within 10 months, as a result of intense agitation, which was directed by the authorities in Kuala Lumpur. The evidence is quite clear. It is not the Singapore leaders who said this. The British diplomats put the blame on Kuala Lumpur. The Australian diplomats put the blame on Kuala Lumpur. There's a US charge who reported contemporaneously, quoting a Malaysian official, criticising UMNO, and one in particular, a politician by the name of Jaafar Alba. You'll come across his name in both your documentary as well as here in the documents very often. He played a major role, riling up the ground, and he was a very, very gifted agitator, as Othman Wok, one of the ministers, Singapore's ministers, describes him. And the ground was agitated and you had race riots. And people who lived together peacefully for generations were suddenly at each other's throats. The worst so-called ethnic riots that happened before the 64 race riots involved Hokkien's fighting Teochews in Singapore. And this was the first Malay-Chinese riots. Right? Yeah. And it just unraveled. And the Singapore leadership was caught in a bind because by then they had no control over the police. The police security was a federal matter, right? It was you had lost control of the police. We didn't even have a Minister for Home Affairs when we were part of Malaysia, right? We had a Minister of Home Affairs between 59 and 63. But we had no control over the police. We had no control of the situation. You were wholly dependent. And it was, you can read their oral histories. They were shocked. They were shocked that all the effort that you had put in to keep the races together could just unravel. If young Singaporeans want to know why Mr. Lee Kuan Yew and his colleagues were so obsessed about putting in safeguards against racial and religious agitation, that was the reason. Right? Almost the first things they did after separation was, in fact, to create structures to ensure minority rights. And then later, they created all sorts of things, including EIP, Ethnic Integration Program, and your MRHA and all the rest.
Yeah. The riots had caused over 20 deaths, I mean, and a few hundred injuries. I mean, it really shocked the whole nation back then.
Yes, there were two riots, by the way, one in July and later in September.
Yeah. Is the racial riot a result of this ongoing, you know?
What Mr. Lee Kuan Yew and Dr. Goh and the other leaders of that time concluded, supported by the analysis of the British diplomats, you go and check the records, they concluded that the Malaysian leaders of that time were using riots, race riots, as an instrument of intimidation. Right? You find Mr. Lee saying in his oral history, they tried the same, they did the same in Penang, in other parts of Malaya, where there were large numbers of minorities. You show who's in charge, right? And immediately after the race riots, the second document in the Albatross file is Dr. Goh's meetings, notes of his meetings with Dr. Tun Razak, the Malaysian Deputy Prime Minister, immediately after the riots. And Tun Razak tells him plainly, we can have peace, you can be part of the coalition. We are prepared to admit the PAP into a coalition government in Malaysia on two conditions. One, Lee Kuan Yew steps down. Two, you keep out of the Malay ground.
Would this have been terms that Singapore leaders would have agreed to?
They would never have accepted it. So remember, the first paper, even before the race riots, Mr. Lee says, if we accept these terms, things will be okay. They'll leave us alone. But we cannot accept this.
Mm-hmm. And this is also comes in the aftermath of in 64 when PAP also went up to contest elections,
yes,
right?
There were a number of things. First of all, they came here and contested. There was supposed to be a gentleman's agreement between Mr. Lee and Tunku, and then I suppose Tunku forgot about it, and then they contested here.
Forgot.
Right? Maybe he assumed UMNO contested in 59, what? So why can't I contest again, right? So anyway, they contested and they lost. If they had won, maybe things would have been delayed, but they lost. And then some in the PAP, not all, Mr. Lee Kuan Yew reluctantly went along with the decision of Dr. Toh Chin Chai, then Deputy Prime Minister, and Mr. Rajaratnam, who was then Minister for Culture, who wanted to contest in the Malaysian general election in 64, yep. April 64. And there, the opposite happened. They fielded a token 9, and they went and campaigned, and the rallies were huge. Huge rallies. I mean, I attended one. I was 10 years old.
Wow.
It's the largest collection of people I've ever seen in Kuala Lumpur. Yeah, it was a huge rally. And Mr. Lee was the star. And he had mobilized. He gave a lot of minorities a lot of hope. And also a sizable number of, you know, what in those days they used to call progressive Malays. Mm-hmm. And he had been, you know, almost like a rock star. What nowadays you would call him rock star. It was huge rallies.
What
and they rattled the Malaysian leaders. Mm-hmm. But they lost all but one seat, right? Nine contested. They were confident they would win almost all. They lost some they lost their deposit.
oh my.
Right? And then only one seat. But still, the Malaysian leaders were rattled by this because of his power and his capacity to mobilize large numbers of people. They hadn't seen a politician like this, right? I mean, they were used to, even from the opposition, relatively, well, much tamer than Mr. Lee, right? And, you know, here was a person who by then was acquiring an international stature and then, of course, showed his capacity to mobilize the ground across all the urban centres. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but in back then, in your memory, the rallies were so powerful and they were so, you know, so many people were rallied. The key message was so clear, you know, a progressive Malaysia.
Why did they lose all?
Yeah, why?
Because the campaign was completely confused, right? Mm. Because they said, support Tunku, right? Tunku is the leader of us all, you know. Mm. There's confrontation because you remember there was confrontation. Indonesia decided to crush Malaysia, Sukarno's Indonesia, and there was confrontation. The British were defending us, Australians and the New Zealanders too. And so Mr. Lee said in this crisis, national crisis, that was the PAP line. In this time of national crisis, we must all stand up against Sukarno in support of Tunku. But they never contested any UMNO held seats. They only contested seats that were held by MCA. But, you know, where we are not standing, vote for Tunku. Where we are standing, you vote for us. So they'll say, you tell me to vote for Tunku, I just vote for Tunku.
I can imagine why that is so confusing.
I think it was a very confusing campaign. In any case, they didn't have an organization. It was a bootstrap campaign. Suddenly they, you know, moved across the causeway. And who are their kakis and helpers and so on, you know, friends of friends, relatives. And Rajarandam organized his brother in Seremban, you know.
Family ties.
Yeah,
But on the flip side, this one seat that was won.
Yeah, only one seat.
What was the significance of this one?
Well, the person who won the seat was my father, Devan Nair, and he happened to win in Bangsa because he was probably the best known among the PAP candidates. Mm. Because, you know, he had been a trade union leader for a long time. And in those days, because the newspapers here were the same as the newspapers there, both English and Chinese, so reports of him here were also carried there. And then from the late 1940s, early 50s, he had also organized the Malayan Teachers Union before he got arrested and so on. So he had a history there and therefore he was probably the best known among the candidates. But even he only won by 800 votes. It was very narrow.
Why could they not stay out of Malaysian politics? You know, why was it so important for them?
I mean, as Mr. Lee says, according to Mr. Lee, Dr. Toh and Rajaratnam and the PAP Central Committee decided on contesting the elections while he was overseas. Actually, he was undertaken a tour of Africa, African nations. It was a 35-nation tour. He was away for 1 month. You know, that's when he began meeting all the great Afro-Asian leaders of that time, you know, Nasser, Ben Bella, and people like that, Nkrumah, you know, all these great figures of the anti-colonial era, and he was away. While he was away, the Central Committee, the PAP Central Committee, led by Dr. Toh Chin Chai and Rajaratnam, both of whom were born in Malaya, or rather Malayan bred, they wanted to contest. And then, by the time Mr. Lee came back, it was a fait accompli. And he says somewhere that if they had not contested, history may have been different. Who knows, right?
Okay, so we know that, you know, in this 1 year after the merger, things were not peaceful. You know, there was conflict across
10 months.
Yeah, not even a year.
To July.
Exactly, exactly.
Then you get the explosion. 10 months.
Less than a year.
Yeah.
Right? That's first period. 10 months, race riots. 12 months, separation.
Oh my. That is all within a year.
Yes.
But the racial riots, I want to go back to that point.
Yeah.
After 10 months, we hit the racial riots. How, you know, what was the reaction of the PAP leaders?
The race riots were a cataclysmic experience for the for everyone in Singapore. It came as a huge shock. And actually, many people in Singapore regretted their support for merger. Mr. Lee, Kuan Yew recalls the president of the Chinese Chamber of Commerce coming to his house. The president of the Chinese Chamber of Commerce at that time had supported merger. And he came to see Mr. Lee and said, look, I feel responsible. What am I going to tell my people? Because we persuaded them to vote for merger. Anyway, Mr. Lee and the rest of the PAP leadership also felt the same way. And Dr. Goh had this to say in his oral history. And it's actually a very, very crucial passage, so I'll read it out as it appeared in the oral history. This is Dr. Goh Keng Swee. It was only after the riots when we were cornered, really cornered, because the Malaysian government could, at will, switch on this riot and get people killed, that Lee decided on a counter-offensive to make life intolerable for them. I think it was Lee's policy that if we were to get good terms out of them, either total separation or a new working agreement, they must find existing arrangements intolerable. And he knew that it had to be done at great risk to himself, but there was no other way because we were at the receiving end all the time. The Malaysian Solidarity Convention, which was about 10 months away, was again another move to bring political pressure to bear on KL, that they cannot get away with a racist policy directed towards Singapore. So they were not in control of the police. Security was a federal responsibility. So the only way in which they could secure Singapore and protect Singapore as best as possible against being the victims of what in effect was racial intimidation, you turn on and off this riot switch. The only way you could protect yourself was to organize politically up and down the peninsula and across Sabah and Sarawak. That was the strategy that he had adopted. Immediately after the riots, according to Dr. Goh, that was the strategy. And he knew that this was a very dangerous strategy because they could have killed him off. How do you deal with somebody who is agitating, who's not going to compromise? His strategy, as Dr. Goh describes it, is I increased the political pressure. That was the only means I had. Political pressure on the ground, in Parliament, right? Every debate, every opportunity, we will debate and we will show who has the better ideas, right? And that was a strategy. So you either agree, Malaysia and Malaysia, or you agree to other arrangements that would allow us to secure ourselves, right? Control of the police, so you cannot use this race riots to intimidate us. That was the turning point.
Jess, what could central government in KL could have done to Mr. Lee? What was the worst that could have happened?
Well, Mr. Lee, in his oral history, says, you know, somebody could have arranged for an accident. You know, you drive up in those days, the trunk roads, they call them the trunk roads, that you didn't have expressways. And they were always huge, big lorries carrying timber. And then you arrange for the timber to be released and your car is smashed. Right.
Oh,
that's it. So that's, you know, he says he can do that. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a direction. I mean, nobody believed that someone, you know, like the Tunku would have ordered something like this. But the Tunku was not the person behind the race riots. It happened despite the Tunku. You know, everyone, by the way, in the Singapore leadership had a lot of respect for the Tunku. Right. But nevertheless, he wasn't in control of all the elements certainly not in control of the extremists. Yeah. And then I suppose less worse, he could have been arrested. Yeah. As they came close to doing.
Let's talk about this rearrangement. You mentioned that if not to fight, we need to talk about this form of rearrangement that's happening.
Because let's go back to the terms of the merger, right? We only had autonomy over labor and education, and then some on health, right? Broadcasting. So your precursors was not controlled by them. That's about it, right? So they wanted to go back. to a different arrangement where what was of primary concern to Mr. Lee is police and special branch. And actually, the proposal for a different arrangement came from the Tunku, right? Tunku, as I recall earlier, always felt that his original idea for merger was better, that you let, as he put it, let Lee Kuan Yew run Singapore and Malaysia will just take care of foreign affairs and defence. So he wanted to go back to that.
Yeah.
And so he was the one who initiated the idea of, as he put it, hiving off Singapore. Right? This was, first he told, said this to Dr. Goh, used the word hiving off, sometime in December 15th, 1964. Mm-hmm. And then December 19th, he met Mr. Lee and repeated his ideas. And the ideas were not clear, but, you know, it was very hazy. You know, somewhere in between, he said Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. Actually, what does that mean? Northern Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas Southern Ireland, what we call Ireland now, is an independent country. So what is it? What's in between an independent country and a part of, you know, of the UK? So, I mean, maybe he had confederation in mind. He had a looser federation in mind. But the main impulse was clear. He wanted Singapore out of their Malaysian parliament. He wanted to go back to the happy old days. Right,
and that would have been 59 to 63, right?
Yes, 59, 63. And, you know, the PAP is out of my parliament. The Singaporeans are not here agitating. And he wanted to go back there, right? And these proposals were taken very seriously. Mm-hmm. The Albatross files, actually most of the documents, cabinet papers and memos in the Albatross file concerns this earlier period. When they were negotiating a confederation or a looser federation. Almost all, except the first two papers I talked about, Dr. Goh's and Mr. Lee's, before and after the race riots. All the rest was about this, right? They were going back and forth, various proposals, and those negotiations collapsed for a number of reasons. Number one, well, the Malaysians were not clear what they wanted. Tunku was quite clear. He wanted Singapore out of parliament. He didn't want to have to argue with Lee Kuan Yew. And he just said, you look after yourself, right? But then he wanted Singapore out of the Malaysian parliament, but he wanted Singapore to pay for defence, help pay for defence, right? So Mr. Lee said, how am I going to pay for something without representation? It's a fundamental principle, right? No taxation without representation. This was the reason why the Americans had a revolution, yeah. Right? And that was one reason. The other reason, the other leaders in Malaysia, again, Tan Siew Sin, he keeps coming up, also objected to some of the terms that they were talking about. And the others, you know, in the Malaysian leadership, like Razak, kept, you know, changing their minds. And Mr. Lee, in this oral history and in the Albatross file documents, expresses his frustration with the way in which they kept changing their minds. The fundamental reason those negotiations failed was the British learned about them. And together with the Australians and the New Zealanders, they blocked the constitutional rearrangement.
It kind of paints us a picture of the British during that period of time. I mean, why do they have the power to do that?
Well, because the British were defending Malaysia against Sukarno.
Yeah.
They were, as the High Commissioner, British High Commissioner to Malaysia at that time, a very distinguished man by the name of Lord Anthony Head, was a former defence minister. So he was a very substantial figure. And Mr. Lee had very high respect for him, and so did Dr. Goh. He learnt about it, and he used all his wiles, and which were considerable, to block the thing. As Mr. Lee describes it, he did it very skillfully. He didn't say no up front. You know, he just took apart your argument piecemeal until you were left with nothing.
Oh.
And the whole thing collapsed. Began December, by March, the whole thing collapsed.
Why? Why did the British...
Well, because they didn't want it. They didn't want... Number of reasons. First of all, they said, we are defending your frontier. Mm-hmm. And the rear is disintegrating. Our international standing will be affected, you know, and it'll seem as though Malaysia has failed. So why are you why are we defending you, right, against Sukarno? Secondly, they didn't want Singapore out of the Malaysian parliament because they felt Singapore's presence in the Malaysian parliament helped protect Sabah and Sarawak.
Oh, yes.
They felt responsible for Sabah and Sarawak. Mm. They were the ones who bundled Sabah and Sarawak into Malaysia. And there was a certain, I suppose, paternal kind of, you know, regard and care that they felt, and a sense of responsibility.
Yep.
They felt for the people whom, you know, mostly indigenous, not necessarily Malay. In fact, at that time, there were Malays were not a sizable portion of the population of Sabah and Sarawak, or a considerable portion. And they thought PAP being in the Singapore being in the parliament would help protect Sabah and Sarawak, right? And they didn't want a society that became too Malay dominant as a result. So they thought Singapore would be a good counterweight. So actually the reasons were sound, right? But what they didn't realize is that by preventing a looser federation, a looser confederation, they got what they didn't want, which was separation. So ironically, if they had not interfered, Singapore would have got to one country, two systems before Hong Kong.
Yeah. But going back to
To get the terms right, looser federation means more autonomy, right?
Yeah.
Confederation means actually two sovereign states. Mm-hmm. Right, and two sovereign states come together, and then you agree on defense or whatever it is. You know,
I mean, it could be anything but separation.
Yeah, but not separation.
When I was reading, going through the Albatross files, it came up to me, who informed the British?
Actually, many people. to begin with, Tunku told Lord Head that he's talking to the Singapore Prime Minister about a looser federation. But then there was another source of information, probably secret at that time. Now, of course, we know, was a man named Claude Fenner, who was the Malaysian Commissioner of Police. I don't know what they called him at that time, Inspector General or maybe Commissioner of Police. He was a British officer. And at that time in Malaysia, they still, even in 64, 63, 65, they still had British officers who continued to serve in the Malaysian government.
Yep.
So the head of their police was British officer, Claude Fenner, and then the head civil servant in the Treasury, the Ministry of Finance, was also a British officer. So the British had many sources of information. Yep. And then the release archives show that Claude Fenner was helped in the papers he wrote by British officials. You know, they used to share information.
Yeah.
So he would have been the other source of information. But the original source seems to have been Tunku himself.
But why did he tell the
because,
British?
Well, that's why when we come later, the separation negotiations, both Mr. Lee and Dr. Goh were so insistent on secrecy.
Who were the ones who negotiated this constitutional rearrangement?
It was a number of people were involved. Mr. Lee in the main, Dr. Goh also was involved, though he says he wasn't involved. But later we looked at the papers. Actually, he wrote the most substantial paper on the possible terms for looser federation. More substantial in terms of working out fully in detailed fashion, you know, which department is a federal responsibility, which can be, you know, Singapore and so on and so on. So it was very detailed. He saw very typical Dr. Goh, you know, very thorough work.
Yep.
We published the political part of that paper, but the more detailed thing, which was a big thing, we did not publish, but we summarized it. And obviously I think that paper was in fact discussed, though there is some doubts as to how many people looked at it. But the Malaysians knew about it, that paper. So a lot of people were involved. And then, more pertinently, Dr. Toh Chin Chai and Rajaratnam opposed this.
Yep.
Forget about separation. They opposed a looser federation. They didn't want to get out of Malaysia. They didn't want to get out of Malaysian politics. And they, Rajaratnam's, the sole paper by Rajaratnam in the Albatross file, Dr. Goh's file, was by Rajaratnam arguing against a looser federation. Very passionate argument. And, you know, you can't say he was wrong because, you know, he says, look, once you get out, you can't get in. And as so happened, that is true.
I mean, we know Mr. Rajaratnam's, I mean, all of them, many of them see themselves as Malaysians, right? So it would have been unimaginable to be out of, you know, out in any way or form.
He argued very strongly. And we don't have Dr. Toh's arguments on record in the Albatross file, but we know from other sources that he also strongly argued against it. And according to Mr. Lee's memoirs, Mr. Ong Pang Boon also opposed him. So those were the three Malayan-bred ministers who were strongest in wanting to fight on, right?
Okay, so we know that the constitutional rearrangement or this, like, you know, looser federation plans fell through much of 1965. Was that
it didn't come to anything?
Well, it didn't come to anything. It's not, it didn't officially end.
Yep.
It's they sort of, you know, sometimes they resurface that idea, including Mr. Lee, up to the last minute, right? As we will talk about in a while, I assume.
So, you know, by the earlier days, earlier months of 1965, I mean, now that the plan has kind of fallen through, I mean, what happened? Did things settle down?
No. December, Tunku, remember I read to you Dr. Goh's description of the dangerous strategy that Mr. Lee adopted in the face of the race riots, right? Well, you do this, you turn on, switch race riots, switch on and off. Well, I'm going to organize, I'm going to fight. In effect, that strategy was working, which is why Tunku offered a looser federation, hiving off, as he put it, right? That was his first response. So that was the strategy, and actually the strategy was working because it forced Tunku's hand and he says, look, I don't want this to carry on. It's too upsetting to my base. And I suppose he felt threatened, right? That that he was faced with a force that was implacable. And so he said, looser federation. Because the British intervened, that was not possible. He had to face other options because Mr. Lee did not, Singapore leadership did not let up the pressure. March, the thing collapsed. By April, May, they were organizing the Malaysian Solidarity Convention. And the first convention happened on June 6th.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In between, there were numerous parliamentary debates. They proposed a budget. Singapore side objected. And they rallied. NTUC held rallies opposing the budget. And they argued in Parliament. And as the British High Commissioner, Lord Head, observed, says every time there is an argument, the Singapore ministers win. Right? So it became intense. And then in between, there was also the famous parliamentary session, the debate on the King's speech, like, you know, like we have the President's speech and then you have a debate on the President's speech. They have the King's speech and they have a debate on the King's speech. This was in May 1965. The then new MP from Kedah, Mahathir, got up and spoke. And he essentially said that Singapore Chinese are only comfortable with Malays who are drivers, sizes, right? Says you're not used to a system where the Malays are in charge. And actually, it was to Mahathir that Mr. Lee made his famous speech.
Okay, so before we get into all these details, we know that, you know, leading up to the 65, you know, things got even more dramatic, you know, more conflict and all the way up to separation. But that we'll have to wait to our second part of the podcast.
Okay. Yeah, let's stick around for part two where we dive deep into the psyche of the top leaders and key players in the separation negotiations. And we'll also find out who did what behind someone's back. See you in the next one.
Yes.